Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity. Good afternoon to everybody. I would like to present some results on a statistical theory developed for fully developed homogeneous isotropic turbulence. So really, it's a simple case, and I tried to derive relations for probability density functions, in this case for the vorticity statistics. So anyway, if you have any questions, just interrupt and ask, feel free to. So this talk is structured like this. I start with an introduction and where I will show you some like visualizations of vorticity field, give you some details on the DNS I'm working with, and then I'll skip over to an overview of the so-called LMN hierarchy. It's like, I will tell you in a minute, it's the statistical framework I'm dealing with. And then I'll come to the physical results about the single point vorticity statistics, and then later on I have some slides about two point vorticity statistics as well. So as probably all of you might know, closure problem of turbulence is a consequence of the nonlinear character of the basic equations of motions, and when you try to derive statistical relations, like for example for moments, you encounter this Friedmann-Keller hierarchy of moment equations where you have a coupling to ever increasing order of moments. If you do the same game for PDFs, you encounter a coupling in terms of an increasing number of spatial points, and this is what I'll be dealing with in this talk. If you encounter these PDF equations and you want to cope with the closure problem, you have a range of possibilities to do so. First of all, you can try to analyze these equations and make some simplifications and learn something about the structure of these equations, or you can additionally then model the unclosed terms, which is really a big business in turbulence research, to obtain a closure in the end. Something what you can also do is use direct numerical simulations or experiments to gain information about the unclosed terms, and this is what I'll be doing. So I will analyze the PDF equations and then use numerics to gain the missing information. Just to set everybody straight, this is my basic equation of motion. It's the vorticity equation for 3D turbulence. So vorticity is the curl of the velocity, and the equation of motion is a convective transport of this vorticity. On the right-hand side, you have this rate of strain tensor times the vorticity. This is a vortex stretching term. Then you have viscous dissipation. And when you want to obtain a statistically stationary state, you have to apply a large-scale forcing in order to drive the flow. So these are the different dynamical influences I have, and what one would like to understand is how do these different influences have their impact on the statistics that we observe. So this is basically the main question I will be following. Before that, just to give you an impression how these fields look like, here's a DNS visualization of the velocity field. It's a volume rendering of the magnitude of velocity. And you can see that the velocity is comparably large scale structured, but has also, like here, like steep gradients. So it's like large scale, but it has wrinkled steep gradients. Compared to that, the vorticity field is made up of these small tubular vortex tubes. So this is just the curl of this field, so to speak. And you see that we have a complicated, entangled structure of vortex tubes. I just skip over to a movie, which shows the temporal dynamics here. It's like a different color scale, a little bit different. We see the same. Here's the vortex tubes, and you see how these get advected by this large-scale velocity field. So this is really the nonlinear dynamics you would like to understand at this point. Okay. Okay, this is a visualization of R lambda 112. If you ask yourself how these fields do develop with Reynolds number, This one is 76 up to 225. And you see that with increasing Reynolds number, the velocity field gets more and more fine scaled and more wrinkled. And you have steeper gradients, but it maintains its large scale structure in the end. When you look at the vorticity, you can observe that with increasing Reynolds, the structures get smaller and smaller, and you get more structures. So the it's the same like for the velocity field. You get an increasing number of small scale structures with increasing Reynolds number. So, okay, so much about the visualization. Coming to the most simple statistical properties that you can observe. These are the single point PDFs of velocity and vorticity. Here are the PDFs of the magnitude drawn. And you see, so if you think of a Gaussian vectorial field, the magnitude of this field will be distributed like this gray line. It's a Rayleigh distribution. And you see that this velocity field is nearly Gaussian distributed with slightly sub-Gaussian tails. And compared to that, you find this highly non-Gaussian shape of the vorticity PDF, indicating that extreme events are orders of magnitude more probable for this vorticity field than for a Gaussian random process. Maybe the second simplest quantity that you can observe are the longitudinal and transversal correlation functions. And you observe that while the velocity has quite slowly decaying correlation functions, vorticity is much more short-range correlated. This is exactly what you would have guessed from the visualizations we just saw. Okay, and for now my goal is to understand these statistics. Okay, just a few words about DNS. It's really like it's a standard pseudo-spectral method with periodic boundary conditions in a box. Time stepping is a third order Runge-Kutta method with adaptive time stepping. We have also Lagrangian tracers, but this doesn't play a role for this talk right now. And it's MPI parallel with a slab domain decomposition by FFTW. So slab domain decomposition is we take this periodic box and cut it into slices, and each processor works with a slice, and one has to communicate from time to time. And so it heavily depends on the performance of the FFTW, and as this is a quite good library, the code scales quite
well. How do you treat pressure which is not local?
So I'm simulating the vorticity equation.
You already get rid of the pressure.
Okay. Otherwise, it isn't a problem as well. I think when you.
But honestly, you need relate velocity to vorticity via SOVAR, which is second right. Of locals. So, I mean, it's not easy way to escape. No?
Yeah. And if you simulate Navier-Stokes, I think this you basically can simulate 3D Burgers equation and then use a projection operator, which is local in Fourier space. So this is how you would do it in case of Navier-Stokes equation. And here I put it in over the divergence-free velocity field due to the SOVAR. Okay, so much about the numerics. It's really just standard. Now coming to the Lundgren-Mooney-Novikov hierarchy, it's a systematic way to derive evolution equations for probability density functions from the basic equations of motion. It was introduced by the authors in the late 60s of the last century, and basically it's nothing else than the BBGKY hierarchy for like in equilibrium or non-equilibrium thermodynamics. It's just deriving evolution equations for probability density functions. So the concept is there are different ways how to derive these equations, but the one I like the most is start with a fine-grained distribution function. So you define a fine-grained distribution function as delta of a realization omega of x and t minus the sample space variable capital omega, which is nothing else than your Binning variable, so to speak. And you can, for example, take derivatives of this definition and then use the hydrodynamical equations to replace the terms that are arising. In that way, you can derive an evolution equation for the fine-grained PDF. So if you want to obtain the PDF evolution of the full PDF, you have to take the ensemble average, and this is exactly where your unclassed terms come in. So there are the terms arising that you don't know, basically. And what I'll be doing then is to exploit statistical symmetries to this equation to simplify the equation. So I'm considering homogeneous, isotropic, and in the end stationary turbulence, and this allows me to make a couple of simplifications. just a short slide with prior works on this topic. So there are these classic works I've just spoken about. And there's a whole industry dealing with reactive flows, like Pope did all these PDF methods for reacting flows and combustion and so on, and many others as well. And there have been some recent theoretical works by Japanese groups who apply analytical closure strategies to this equation in order to predict the shape of the PDFs in the end. And of course there are many others, and I might have forgotten half of them, so if anybody is working on that, I apologize if I didn't mention right now. I cannot go into all the details how to derive this set of equations, and it would probably bore you, so I just sketched the structure of the equations. The full hierarchy looks like this. If you derive an evolution equation for the single point PDF, you get somehow a coupling, for example, due to this Biot-Savart integral to the two-point PDF. So you integrate over the two-point PDF, and additionally you need information from the forcing at a single point in space. So F1 couples to F2. If you do the same for F2, you obtain a coupling to F3 and additional information from the forcing and so on. And this is how you eventually encounter your infinite hierarchy of evolution equations. You can choose to truncate, formally truncate it on a given level by introducing conditional averages. This is nothing else than Bayes' Bayes' theorem. So it's just, if I do it on the nth level, I see that the endpoint PDF evolves due to these terms, and there the velocity field conditioned on n vorticity shows up. So this is nothing more than asking the question, how does the velocity field look like given I find a certain vorticity configuration of n vorticities? So, and if I can specify this quantity, I can close this term. And in the same manner, the conditional right-hand side of the vorticity equation arises. So I have to specify, for example, what is vortex stretching like in a given point, given I have a certain vorticity configuration. So this is basically my closure problem at this point. Okay. So if you have to deal with this hierarchy with a full endpoint, for example, endpoint PDF equations, you can ask yourself, okay, what kind of information can be derived from this, because it's a quite coupled, complicated set of equations. And more physically speaking, you can ask, what's the connection between the statistics that we observe and the different dynamical features coming up in these conditional averages? So, like, how does vortex stretching influence the PDF, for example? And finally, one would like to make a connection between the statistics that one observes and the local structure of the field. So one would like to make a connection between vortex tubes and statistics in the end. So I have not fully succeeded with this, but I can give you a couple of ideas that I've been working on here. So here, now I will be talking about three different aspects of the single point equation. So you will see something, what one can call a conditional balance equation. Then I make a contact to the shape of the vorticity PDF and make a quick comparison to the velocity statistics. And finally, I will make a connection to the local structure. And after this, we move over to two-point entropy statistics. Okay, so what I'm doing is to start with the PDF equation for the single point PDF, like it is known from the hierarchy. then I'll use statistical symmetries, and this will allow to give me two different versions of which one yields this conditional balance. And I will also derive an a stationary solution to the PDF equation, which contains unclosed terms. And then I will go to the DNS, estimate this unclosed terms, and this will allow me to discuss and to obtain the shape of the PDF in the end. So anybody's interested, I can give all the mathematical details later on, but it's I guess a bit too messy for this talk right now. So if you introduce the conditional averages on the single point level, the single point PDF for homogeneous flow is just a temporal derivative of F1, and then you have the divergence of a probability current. And this probability current is given by the conditional right-hand side of the vorticity equation times the PDF. So these three influences, like dissipation and vortex stretching and external forcing, need to be known to close this type of equation. Okay, then I apologize for this a bit technical slide. This is how you introduce the statistical averages. Isotropy means that the statistical quantities will be invariant with respect to rotation. So you have to write down all of your conditional averages and statistical quantities in a way that they are invariant towards these symmetry transformations. And maybe the simplest is the PDF of the vector. For isotropic flow, the PDF of the vector can only depend on the magnitude of vorticity. So here we have a function of a vector, and it's related to a function of a scalar, just like this. So this is the first simplification you can do. The second thing is, maybe let's focus on this one. We have the conditional Laplacian, which is a vector conditioned on a vector. But when you want to achieve that this is invariant with respect to rotations, it may, in a statistical sense, only point into the direction of the conditioning vector. With a scalar prefactor, which depends on the invariant, and the invariant of that vector is the magnitude. So what you achieve is, you know that this quantity points into omega direction with an unknown prefactor, which depends on the magnitude. And this prefactor is nothing else than the projection of the Laplacian, of the Laplacian onto the current direction of vorticity. So, and this is what you can do with all the terms. Here for the rate of strain tensor, this the second order tensor, which has this general structure. I mean, you all know this type of simplification when you deal with, for example, correlation tensors. You write down ui, uj is delta ij, longitudinal plus transversal. So it's the same, just in omega space right now. And it turns out, as this tensor is traceless, that it can be characterized by a single a scalar function sigma, which is nothing else than a normalized rate of entropy production. Okay, now you take these bunch of terms and plug it into this equation, and then you obtain what I call version one. So it's completely the equivalent equation, but now it's one-dimensional, because we have used all these simplifications. You see that now the PDF of the magnitude evolves due to this probability current, where you have vortex stretching, viscous diffusion, and the external forcing. So we have reduced from a vectorial PDF equation to a scalar PDF equation, which is a huge simplification, also when it comes to estimate the terms from DNS. So this is basically why I started it. But you can already obtain a theoretical result from this equation, because when you look for stationary turbulence, you know that for a one-dimensional problem, the probability flux has to vanish. So you can conclude from this equation that this conditional balance of vortex stretching and viscous dissipation holds. So can directly conclude that on the statistical average there has to be this balance. However, one does not know from this how these different terms add up to zero. That's where the numerics comes in, and we've just estimated these terms from the numerics, and here on the x-axis is magnitude of vorticity, and here's a conditional average. Let's take the vortex stretching term. You see that it's this red line. It's positively correlated with vorticity. That means that, what everybody knows, vortex stretching is capable of amplifying vorticity. The Laplacian is here plotted with a sign, so it's negatively correlated with vorticity. It damps vorticity. But the interesting fact now is that vortex stretching equals minus viscous dissipation, so that the external forcing does not have any influence. So the conditional forcing of the conditional average of the forcing with respect to vorticity is zero.
Which must be so. External force acts the most on the scale.
Right. So this is the usual argument, but here's an example that it actually works. So, yeah. So
all this noise at large omega, this is just a lack of statistical averaging.
You see here we are like 25 standard deviations, and the PDF starts.
This number is decreased.
Yeah. Okay, so the reason is just large-scale forcing conditioned on a small-scale quantity has to vanish. So we know that the statistics of the PDF will not depend on the external forcing, which everybody might have guessed, but here it's like it's a good example for a deep coupling of large-scale and small-scale statistics.
But it's not a proof that it does not depend on the forcing. In the sense that would you change, for that you would need to change different statistics of forcing and then see that it somehow influences it.
Okay, what one can say, it does not influence the statistics over the forcing term directly. I mean, it could be that it might somehow change the shape of like vortex stretching, for example. But what we did is we tried several large-scale forcing methods and also varied the forcing scale a little bit, and it seemed to be robust. So
why the other term? What is the other term?
It's just a PDF shown for reference.
PDF. Okay.
So that you see that here the wiggling appears because we're in the far tail of the PDF.
Sure.
So I just wanted to give the reference where we are in. Yeah. I'm sorry for not explaining. Okay. From this version one, you could obtain this conditional balance, but one would now like to derive a relation for the shape of the PDF. And there you have to use, once again, homogeneity. This allows you to replace the dissipative terms with the first derivative in omega with second derivatives in omega, where this so-called conditional enstrophy dissipation tensor enters. So it's really a straight calculation which you have to believe at this point. So this quantity is like d omega I over dxk, d omega j over dxk. So it relates to the gradients of vorticity. And for homogeneous flow, you can just express it in terms of its eigenvalues. So for example, the trace is just lambda plus 2 mu, and like when you project it on the vorticity, you get lambda. So this is how you can obtain these eigenvalues locally in the field. And you can now plug this term in for the viscous dissipation. That's why no capital lambda is here anymore. And you obtain a second version of the PDF equation, where now vortex stretching, external forcing, and the eigenvalues of this enstrophy dissipation tensor show up. And you see by this we have one second derivative. And if we set this to zero, we can derive a stationary solution to this equation, which quantifies the shape of the PDF in terms of these correlations I've just discussed. Just for a minute, I show you these eigenvalues. So lambda and mu both depend strongly on the magnitude of vorticity, which just means that there's a strong correlation between the vorticity and its gradient. So if it would be statistically independent, it would be more like a straight line here. Here, mu and lambda force are shown. That means lambda is not equal to mu, and this has the consequence that this tensor has off-diagonal elements. So it's not isotropic.
Could you show it back how much non-equal they are?
I'm sorry.
Sorry.
So this is lambda 4.
I have over 4.
So
4 is the same. Is there any reason why it's approximately equal to 4? It's approximately the same relation for Lyapunov exponents. If you look at Lyapunov exponents, for example, in three-dimensional turbulence, there are two of them positive and one of them is negative. There's this.
Okay.
And oh, then, right. This has to do with this ratio. Yeah. And then the second one is kind of one quarter of.
I think there's another reason for this.
Nobody
you think
able
that
to
this
derive
is somehow related
yeah,
to
the reason for.
Okay, I would happy to somebody explain this to me later on. Because I've been thinking about it, and I think it somehow relates to the tube-like structure.
Of course. It tells you something about this energy flux in the system. And energy flux is something very peculiar. It means that you have, generally, you can compress any element by compressing it in two directions and expanding in one.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can compress it in one direction and expand in two. And they are two different possibilities, and they have different weight. If you really want to have a flux towards small scale, then this need to have a different weight. And
okay.
It also tells you something about the tensor of deformation. It must be some.
Actually, it's the S, the property is, what do you call it, it's property in the S. The stretching,
yes.
Stretching has eigenvalues, and they have a typical ratio. So this guy is just a response to that. So they are the response.
But how to relate it? Now we are in sample space.
You may not know that 18 years ago I did almost that.
Okay.
But you just completed what I have not done.
Okay.
I don't have the equation below that. I'll listen to you next. Okay.
Okay. Maybe you
18
can show
years
me
ago, I already write down the conditional equation for the vorticity.
Okay.
And derive the vorticity PDF completely.
Okay.
Okay.
So maybe you can make me aware of things.
You try to fit it by power law.
Yes. It's
square.
So if you start a calculation analytically from the Burgers vortex, you get omega squared.
Yeah.
But this is omega to 2.5.
It's close to what I gave. Yeah.
Okay.
18 years ago.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
I was
go
just
ahead.
In high school back then, so maybe.
Go ahead.
Okay, now I take all of these conditional averages and plug it into this stationary PDF. So this is what the stationary PDF looks like. It's vortex stretching, the forcing, the dissipative terms showing up, and if you take all of these terms, plug it in, you obtain like this perfect match. It has to be like this.
It has to be so.
So it's just the bend.
The consistency of the method. Yeah.
Yeah, but now we can say like, okay, we find this highly non-Gaussian shape of the PDF because there are strong correlations between.
Yeah. And I have an analytical model for sigma and for phi.
Okay.
I given it 8 years ago, and I fit also with the same thing.
Okay, maybe.
So, so that would be very interesting to combine your work with what I have done. It,
yeah.
This is
so,
a two-free model.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Something else you can conclude is that this external forcing we've seen in the beginning, it doesn't matter.
That
so
means,
you can
it's
just
not, it's
cross
not.
It from this equation.
Yeah.
And then you have an expression of the PDF in terms of vortex stretching and dissipation in the end, which is like physically appealing. Of course, you now wouldn't the next step already done might be 18 years.
Yeah. It's there, so we can combine the two, yes.
would be to calculate this term from some kind of model. So I did it, for example, for an ensemble of Burgers vortices.
Okay.
But you will get wrong results, basically.
Oh,
so you will like match something like It's non-Gaussian, but it doesn't completely match the PDF. And also this ratio of lambda and mu doesn't work out. So the Burgers vortex is too simple to explain this kind of statistics. Okay, so just a quick comparison how this looks like in case of velocity statistics. So when you do velocity statistics, you get the conditional right-hand side where you have pressure, external forcing, and viscous dissipation. And what you see here, for example, this is again this diffusive term, which is again negatively correlated. Pi is the pressure term, the conditional pressure gradient, and this is a very peculiar form. It's like it's negative for low values of velocity, mm-hmm. and it gets positive for high values of vorticity. That means on the statistical average, the pressure gradient tends to decelerate low velocity events and tends to accelerate high velocity events. And the remaining term here is the external forcing. And this is like, it's roughly linear and then seems to saturate. I wouldn't bet on that. But the main difference is that the external forcing cannot be neglected in terms of the velocity statistics. Because it's like large-scale forcing and large-scale velocity, so there should be some kind of correlation.
This is Gaussian forcing that we used here for this green line.
The forcing is just we freeze the magnitude of large-scale modes.
That's the oracle I invented that. The super force.
Okay.
That's 22 years ago. Because super force.
Yeah, I'm sorry. So.
And you did not try other forces.
Yeah, we tried other forces.
We tried also large-scale shear flow, basically. And we tried, we didn't try any stochastic forcing right now, but we tried different deterministic large-scale forcing. But the results are robust. So you might have. It looks a little bit different, but the interpretation stays entirely
which
the same.
Which is the force from is the black one? Which line is the force?
It's the green here.
Oh, the green one, okay.
So it's positively correlated.
Okay.
So forcing does accelerate particles.
Right.
So
that makes sense. The pressure is somehow a little bit unexpected, this correlation.
Sure.
I've never seen it.
That's interesting.
Shall we work completely?
Yeah, it's very interesting.
So, one more interesting thing about this, this is the mean pressure gradient has to vanish for stationary turbulence.
You don't think there's some sign problem? Just exactly switch the sign? No?
No, because then we know that these three terms have to add to zero.
Okay.
So we have a check if it works.
The Mnuchin theorem will suggest that you would see higher pressure for lower velocities. Yeah, and there are kind of general theorems inside, you know, the maximum of pressure is where the minimum of velocity on every streamline.
Mm-hmm.
High pressure corresponds to low velocity modulus, at least. Okay. Here is velocity modulus, right?
Yeah.
And what you show that it's completely, I mean, your pressure is with respect to some mean pressure, yeah. Right?
No, it's homogeneous. So I write down the definition. It's just like minus U. Correct. Pressure. So this is exactly the quantity we are looking at. It's a negative pressure gradient projected on the direction of velocity.
Okay.
This is what.
And so the balance, the dissipation, right?
Yeah. Right.
Oh, it makes sense.
And
it all makes sense.
Okay. So I can be. By the way, the mean pressure gradient has to vanish for isotropic turbulence, and this is why the zero crossing appears.
Yeah.
So if you multiply this conditional average by this PDF and integrate, it has to give a zero. So you know that when this term is non-vanishing, it has to have a zero crossing.
So this indeed. So if it's V grad pressure, then when gradient pressure is positive, then it decelerates. Or negative, then it accelerates relative to velocity.
Yeah. Okay, and these are the corresponding eigenvalues of the kinetic energy dissipation tensor, and you see they are approximately the same. which is opposed to the velocity case. This means that the conditional energy dissipation tensor is approximately isotropic. It doesn't have off-diagonal elements. And at the same time, you see that for low values of velocity, we have a straight line, which indicates statistical independence of the dissipation field from the velocity field. However, if you consider high values of vorticity, you get this banded shape here with increased correlations between the dissipation and velocity.
When it crosses the axis, did you find that changed with like Reynolds number or anything? Because it seems to be like a 2.25 or something like that.
Had a look in a range from like 75 to 225, yeah. And we did not find conclusive statement on that. So
it's a function of velocity or vorticity, the second picture.
This is also now it's a velocity statistic, and it's all a function of the modulus of velocity.
But nu and lambda is defined for
I'm sorry. I just wanted to give this quick slide. Now these are the eigenvalues of the
velocity gradient. Yeah.
So, okay. So whole theory now for velocity, just for this slide. I'll be back in.
You're involving velocity, not vorticity.
Yeah.
Because that's how you get pressure.
Yeah. Right. So so I just wanted to show how the same kind of theory yields very different results when you have a look at a different quantity, because the statistics of this quantity is very different. Of course, you can now use again these. Yeah?
What is the exponent of the heavy tail of the
TPF? Actually, it's no heavy tail. I just switch to the next slide. So this would be an angle integrated Gaussian, which decays with minus v squared. So it's slightly below minus v squared. And you can see how these correlations that we just observed contribute to the slight deviations from Gaussianity. You can imagine that because here is this upbending, and all these terms show up in the denominator of the stationary solution, these tend to like to a little bit depress the tail of the PDF. That's why. Or this is one of the reasons why we find this slightly sub-Gaussian.
The higher velocity, the faster you dissipate it.
So to speak. Yeah. And this is what causes the deviations from Gaussianity. So like a simple but a little bit oversimplified statement would be, we find sub-Gaussian velocity PDFs because there is a correlation between the dissipation field and the velocity field. All right. Okay, now, just to compare it, for the velocity we had this Gaussian core where the dissipation field and the velocity only correlate weakly, and then the sub-Gaussian tails due to this correlation, and one hand waving way of argumenting here would be we have a scale separation between, for example, dissipation and the velocity. And then exactly the same does not hold in case of the vorticity statistics, where we have strong correlations between the vorticity and its gradients. And this is what eventually causes these highly non-Gaussian tails of the vorticity PDF.
Just a quick what's the data you use for that investigation?
This was 500. How big the velocity is? It's 112. 512
cube.
Yeah. 512
cube.
Yeah, right. So it turned out that it's not important to have high resolutions, but to have long simulation runs,
right.
To have really homogeneous isotropic turbulence,
yeah.
For your statistical ensemble. And it's really important to have spatially well-resolved fields, because you have to calculate all the gradients. You have to calculate vorticity, and then you have also to calculate the Laplacian of vorticity.
Okay.
So you really need a high spatial resolution, and that's why we're going for comparably small Reynolds numbers.
That's okay.
How is it forced?
It's this freezing of the large-scale modulus in Fourier space, and we let the phases evolve freely.
Integrated over this K-shape.
No. Basically, it evolved due to Navier-Stokes. The phases evolved due to Navier-Stokes.
No, I mean that the larger scale forcing over, yeah. Is the, over the K,
yeah.
Shell. to maintain the same energy.
Yeah, okay. Right.
That's the simple force.
Yeah, okay. Maybe I should have cited you. I'm sorry.
That's okay. But I will tell you a few papers.
Sure. Okay, now next question would be how this relates to the local structure. And I should explain what local structure means. I mean the conditional vorticity fields. So you sit in a place, fixed vorticity, and ask yourself, how does the field on average look in the neighborhood of this fixed vorticity? So it's omega of x conditioned on a sample space omega, and this will be a function of distance for homogeneous isotropic turbulence. And then you can introduce something like a cylindrical coordinates. So this is the z direction, this is the radial direction, and this is the azimuthal direction, which is something like a twist to this twisting contribution to this field. And then you will have three scalar prefactors, which depend on the invariance that you can calculate from omega and r. So it's the modulus of omega and r, and it's the angle between those two vectors. And these three scalar functions are just a projection of this field onto the vectors. So this is how I decompose my conditional vorticity field. And the interesting fact now is that this, for example, this dissipative term I've been discussing, the conditional Laplacian, depends on the scalars A and B only. And the vortex stretching term depends on the scalar C only. And this is quite interesting. By the way, this was derived by Novikov like 1993, so this is well known, but almost never cited, so to speak. So you see that this term is related to enstrophy production, whereas these two terms are related to dissipation.
It's Novikov, derived it analytically?
Basically, he was in, I guess the. So he did all these calculations in Fourier space. He basically derived these relations in Fourier space, and I was calculating them in real space. And after that, when I was done after a month of calculation, I just found out that basically he had this relation in Fourier space.
So it's rigorous?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It's like you can show that the vortex stretching term is something like the Biot-Savart integral over the conditional vorticity field, and then you have to take the gradient of this. And when you decompose this conditional vorticity field, this vortex stretching couples to one of these scalars only. It's a straight calculation.
And it's just average out.
Yeah.
Other direction is just the average out is zero.
I'm not sure if it's.
It's completely
rigorous. But I don't know if one could say that it's due to averaging. It's basically that these terms vanish. So we can go through the calculations. They are quite instructive. So.
Because it's pure geometry.
Yeah.
If it's pure geometry, that's okay. That's great. Yeah.
So it's only related to the structure of the Biot-Savart integral.
I see.
So,
okay.
In the end. And just to recall this single point PDF equation, this term now can be quantified in terms of this C, this term in terms of A and B, and forcing can be crossed out as we have seen from the numerical results. So one can obtain a closure of this equation by knowing the conditional structure. So, and when you go to numerics and estimate the structure, this is what comes out. So we fix vorticity in z direction, and now from top left to bottom right, we increase the magnitude of vorticity. So when you increase the magnitude of vorticity, the field gets more and more twisted. So, and it's really this twisted structure which relates to the enstrophy production. Just for comparison, if I take the same two-point correlation for a Gaussian field, this is what comes out for a Gaussian field. So you have also a bundle, basically like a vortex tube, but mm-hmm. this twisting structure is missing. So in
again, I'm sorry. In 1990, in my Nature paper,
okay.
I especially showed this twisted thing.
It's yeah, but
it's not a simple tube.
Right, and I know this paper. You showed it for the like for a single vortex tube.
Yeah, right.
And this is like a typical vortex tube
typical
when you vortex. When you.
I totally agree with
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
But just that one that we can easily visualize.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah,
and this is why, because for example, when you take the Burgers vortex,
yeah.
The Burgers vortex doesn't have this twist. And that is why it fails here. Okay, how much time do I have left?
10 more minutes.
Okay.
Oh, five.
Yeah, that would be great. Will work. Okay, so much about the single point statistics. Now what we wanted to do is move on to more points in space, so we did two-point statistics. And when you want to evaluate two-point vorticity statistics, you would have to evaluate the vector at two different vectors. So it's not feasible to estimate these histograms from DNS. So we made a projection onto the entropy. So we just have a look at two-point entropy statistics right now. And when you derive such an evolution equation, it basically looks the same like the ones we've seen before. We have here entropy production at a single point in space, conditioned on two entropies in space. We have dissipation, the same at the second point in space. This is just the same like in case of the single point statistics. But now a new term shows up, which is the conditional velocity increment. And it's only the longitudinal velocity increment which shows up. And it's related to derivatives with respect to the distance. So this the coupling of different spatial scales comes up because the two entropies communicate via the velocity field with each other. So we have a spatial coupling due to the velocity field. Once again, estimating these terms from DNS. So here is omega 1 and omega 2. Red is entropy production. So just like in case of a single point statistic, it points outwards or is positively correlated. That means we have an amplification. The diffusive term depletes it. But when you add up these two terms, they do not cancel pointwise. There's a small net vector field, which is hardly visible from this visualization I can give you. You will see it on the next slide. So these don't cancel for small distances. And at the same time, this is a conditional velocity field. So for omega 1 and omega 2, that means when you have roughly the same vorticity at two nearby points, this conditional velocity field is positive. That means these two points drift away from each other on the statistical average. If you have strongly differing vorticities, like here small omega 2 and large omega 1, these two points get attracted on the statistical average. And once again, like for the pressure, the mean has to vanish. So if you multiply this by the two-point PDF and integrate out, you get a zero. That's why you know if this term is non-vanishing, it has to have zero crossings. And this is how it develops. And now you have to take a look at this statistics across scales. So this is for like one eta, really nearby. The two-point PDF now is almost delta function. It's very narrow. And these terms describe how the PDF evolves in scale. So when you, this is now the black vector field is now the sum of vortex stretching or entropy production and dissipation. So when you follow this vector field, something like from here, you will get an increase of vorticity, and once the vorticity has leveled, you get a slight decay. So it's really like you can see it in higher resolution that there is a small decay. So it's like a life cycle. Let's say we have a strong vortex here and a very weak one here. The weak one gets amplified, and once we have amplified or leveled vorticity, the vortex decays. And at the same time, you have to move from this picture to this picture because there is an interaction of scales. So for small scales, the dynamics is like that.
Exactly, yeah. The axis here, the axis and y is what?
So this is like, I've not plotted it in terms of the entropy, but in terms of the modulus of vorticity. So this is vorticity in point one and vorticity in point two.
Okay.
For a fixed spatial distance. And this picture is for 1.2 eta, and this picture is for 2.5 eta.
You'll be interested to take an element and follow it, and to
like
see how
Lagrangian.
Yeah, the history that is going to run in this diagram.
Yeah.
And then make the circles.
Yeah, basically, when you try to solve these equations, you can use the method of characteristics.
Yeah.
And that means nothing else than following these lines. Right. In sample space, so
to
speak.
You can measure the lifetime that way.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah. Okay, now when you move to large spatial distances, I'll just discuss this picture here. The two PDFs factorize. So this is just the product of f of omega 1 and f of omega 2. And you see that for large distances, also this conditional velocity field has vanished. That just means these points don't communicate anymore. And you see that this net vector field has vanished. So
5, 6 eters, how many Kalman Warp scale you need to go to see this qualitative change?
So now we are at...
This is 40, I understand.
Yeah.
But like say, when you have 5, you'll still see correlated.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure, it's like 2. I would say, like, this is 2.5, I would say like to 15 or 20 eta.
On 15 or 20, there's a correlation persisting.
Yeah.
And what is the Taylor scale?
It's like a couple of eters, like 4, 5 or something, yeah. So, otherwise, if it would not be persistent to comparatively large scales, the PDF would not deform anymore across scales. So as long as you observe a deformation of the PDF, there still have to be non-vanishing vector fields, so to speak. Okay, so this is now the net vector field is zero again. That just means we obtain or we recover the balance of entropy production and dissipation once again. So this is where like the dynamics has stopped. So this is all I can tell you about two-point statistics right now, and we're quite trying to derive models that model these like these life cycles of vortices, and this is the current state of work here. Okay, to sum up, Lunke and Moon and Novikov hierarchy might be a good framework for deriving statistical relations for fully developed turbulence, and up to now we are forced to use DNS to gain information about unclosed terms. For the single point vorticity statistics, you could observe this balance of entropy production dissipation, and when you want to quantify the shape of the PDF, you additionally have to take into account these eigenvalues of the conditional dissipation tensor. So I've shown you how these terms relate to the local structure of the field, where especially this twist is important. And for two-point vorticity statistics, additionally, the scale transfer due to velocity comes up. If anybody is interested in this, we have done the same for Rayleigh-Binard convection for the temperature statistics there. And then you can discuss like the typical heating and cooling of a fluid parcel there. Basically with the same kind of methods. So I would like to say thank you very much for your attention and for your questions.
Okay, just historical perspective on this. And what I've done is to actually write down a model for the sigma.
Mm-hmm.
And also, but the dissipation is the linear term.
Yeah.
And the sigma is modeled by nonlinear term of omega power alpha.
Okay.
That was what I did. And actually, it gave out an analytical solution because there is I use the mapping closure for the attention of the magnitude. And the idea is mapping from the Gaussian field to the non-Gaussian field.
Yeah.
And so it turns out that a single alpha is actually described very well the all the numerical PDF of vorticity.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's just it looks like it's a continuation of your work. So I have not done is that go from exactly as you did to all go around all to get to the scalar vorticity equation and then identify the signal and then to put the model on it.
Yeah.
I just brute force and strong.
Okay.
So that's I developed this two free model. This is a free model. There's a mean stretching and also there's a nonlinear stretching. Oh, by the way, sigma has two terms. One is a linear term with a mean stretching background, and another is nonlinear stretching. So the two term action actually accomplish Gaussian core and a non-Gaussian tail.
Okay.
That was about 18 years ago.
Did you do it in sample space or in real space?
In real space.
Okay, so all these results are in sample space. So one has to look for correlations between, so to speak, vorticity and vortex stretching.
Oh,
then.
Well, if you call that sample space, I also sort of in that sample space.
Okay.
The equation only has a meaning in a statistical sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And so this is. Yes.
Did you try to compare your vorticity PDF with some known distributions?
With what?
With some known distributions, you know.
Yeah.
There is something called the normal inverse Gaussian.
I didn't exactly try this one, but I had a look at like Levy distributions and so on.
Yeah.
And I always find, yeah, you can find distributions which match in a certain range of vorticity values, but I believe that these distributions don't belong to any like mathematically tractable distributions. They are distributions for turbulence, and so I don't think that it.
But the solution can actually write down in analytic form. The one I just said it is analytic form.
If you know this form, if you know this field, this conditional averages, it's straightforward to write the solution in terms of this as a function of all.
When you have analytical,
what I mean is that the actual numerical observed function actually can be written in a very analytical form of it, and there is a corresponding non-linear. A focal point equation for it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I mean. It's, there's a closed form.
Yeah.
And so it's not in any name, but the closed form can be written.
No. But you know, these normal inverse Gaussian work very well. I mean, you can take several turbulence experiments and you can collapse them all.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
For vorticity?
Yeah.
Well, no, this was actually done for velocity, for the 2-point velocity,
mm-hmm.
you know, correlations.
Yeah.
So I'm curious if it works for vorticity.
Me too? I don't know.
But then at a common again, the form that I derived out of 2-point velocity, and that I have two PRL papers in 1993, 1991, 1992 on that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the
prior. Stretched exponent tail, I mean, it's just, it's not a convex, it's concave.
In other words, that the 2-point velocity PDF just look like vorticity, mm-hmm. but it was increasing that non-Gaussianity, and that form a scaling or scaling argument. That was the paper 1991. There's two or three PRL paper on this.
Okay.
Outside
you have papers. To immediately give it to me. So.
Okay. Yeah. Let's end this video.